Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. The first segment of our show. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Bev Watson from Dreams Take Flight. Tell me a little bit about Dreams Take Flight.
Dreams Take Flight is a 100% volunteer organization, a registered charity, that takes children who are either physically, mentally, or socially challenged for a trip of a lifetime to a Disney park in either Florida or California.
So how do you go about providing transportation?
Well, Air Canada, through the Air Canada Foundation, generously donates us 8 planes. We have 8 chapters across Canada, Halifax, Montreal, Ottawa, Toronto, Winnipeg, Calgary, Edmonton, and Vancouver. And each year they donate a plane to each of those cities. And we have some people that sponsor our flights and help pay for fuel and landing fees and getting kids into the park. So we go out to various charities, the Boys and Girls Club, children with disabilities, hospitals, CNIB, MS societies, and we select children that would be able to take a very hectic day, because our days start usually about, for most chapters, about 3 in the morning. You get to the airport, and then after some getting some clothing and some new shoes, the kids get on the flight and go down to Disneyland or Disney World and have a fun-filled day, and they aren't home until usually around 1 o'clock in the morning. So it's a very hectic day.
So what are some of the challenges in providing this incredible opportunity?
Some of the challenges, a lot of the children are on meds, and we keep on telling the parents, don't worry about if you have your child on meds, tell us what they are, so that we can make sure that they're taken care of properly during the day. And inevitable, some parents don't tell us and come to the airport and drop off a whole bag of pills. Or they tell us they've got pills and don't bring them. We have 2 doctors on our flight usually, and they go over all the medical records of the kids to make sure that they are able to do the day. Another thing is sometimes the children have some disabilities where they need special care, and so we have to make sure that they're very well taken care of.
So, to look at the converse side of things, in your time with Dreams Take Flight, is there any success story that stands out for you?
Oh, we have so many success stories. We have children that have been on the flight, and part of the criteria is that they would never be able to, in the foreseeable future, go on a trip like this. And now we have people that went, because our first flight started, it'd be 30 years next spring, our first flight took off. And now we have some of those children coming back to be helping on the flight, to be volunteers. Some of them are now nurses, have good professions. And a lot of them will credit it back to when they were first with Dreams, when they came on our trip. we had one little child that had cerebral palsy, and he came from a small town. And the mother was on the trip with him because of his disabilities. And she said to me afterwards, she said, you know, she said, I can't thank you enough for this trip. She said, we come from a small town. My son is the only one that has this disability. And she said, he's always been quiet. He's held himself back. She said, today he learned that other children have the same thing he does. And he became a leader today. She said, he was saying, you know, let's do this, let's do that, and talking to the kids and taking charge. She said, it was so rewarding to see that. He said, because he's grown into a whole new person in just one day. And that's an success story to me.
So if you could send any message to the community about why this work is important, what it means to these kids, what would you say?
It changes their life. Not only does it change their life, it changes their family's life. A lot of these children, not all of them, but some of them come from some, you know, very hard times. They're not used to being treated like gold. You know, a lot of them come from loving families, don't get me wrong, but some of them come from families that are very dysfunctional. And as this is something that it's not a well-known charity. We're just a small charity, and it's important for people to realize that, you know, to give to smaller charities as well as large ones. Because you may not recognize their work, but it's just as important as any charity. We touch a group of children that would never, ever get these chances if it weren't for us.
So
and I think that people have to really look in their hearts and give to good causes.
So when you mention children coming from dysfunctional backgrounds, what do you think the long-term impact of a happening like this would have on them?
Well, I think the long-term impact is that the kids see that people care. People who are total strangers will go out of their way to give them a day like they've never had before. And I think that sends a good message to them. You know, and as I say, some of the kids are coming back and they're helping, and they just said it was a day that was always in my mind. And they go back and usually they get a photo book after the flight, and some of them still have those photo books from years ago. You know, we in Winnipeg, they just celebrated the 25th anniversary, and we had kids, and they said, you know, I still have my shirt. I kept my shirt and my hat. To them, some of these kids, it's the first new thing they've got. So to them, it was, we got something that we never had before. Nothing was expected of them other than to have a good day from people that they didn't know.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
In the next segment of our show, we'll hear from Sukaina Dada from York University. She'll be telling us a little bit about the latest happenings with her disabilities research. So I heard you attended the recent Disability Summit in Ireland. Can you tell me a little about that?
Yes, that's correct. The NUI Galway International, the university, put on an international disability law summer school. And six participants from York University had gone, so three master's students and three PhD students, and we had one student who was actually an exchange student from York University, and it was an absolutely amazing experience. The theme of the program was moving forward, intersectionality as a tool of social change, and speakers included Rosemary Kias, Gerard Quinn, Teresa Dedgener, and current and former committee members of the UNCRPD. And this was really valuable because we were able to talk about some of the most pressing issues right now, such as the global refugee crisis, reproductive and health rights for women with disabilities and girls with disabilities. We were able to talk about some of the most pressing issues right now within the human rights framework that are happening internationally, such as the migrant crisis right now in the United States.
So
it was really an amazing experience.
So what was your biggest takeaway from it?
I think the first thing is that we have a lot of work to do in terms of human rights for persons with disabilities. I think we need to really, really get together different agencies, different organizations, different academic institutions, and really hone in on why persons with disabilities are not entitled to basic human rights. Because when we think of something like the global immigration crisis, people living with disabilities are oftentimes not even considered when it comes to asylum, or when it comes to getting help or support. Unfortunately, it's almost like there's this totem pole, and people living with disabilities are at the bottom. And it's beyond high time that we as societies and communities get together and really fix this issue, and really bring to light some of the global injustices that are occurring, including ones that are occurring right in our own backyard.
So in this sense, you got to figure, especially with migration and immigration, a lot of the places these people are coming from, disabilities aren't a highly regarded status, therefore they wouldn't have the same legal protections, the same considerations that we would. Certainly in transit, not access to any of the proper mobility equipment or what have you.
Yes, most definitely. And oftentimes even the receiving countries are not receptive or are not accommodating. And that's also a problem. I mean, Canada has been critiqued extensively for its discriminatory immigration policy. And I think that's something that we need to bring to light, and we need to discuss, and we need to examine our policies and see why is it that this is still occurring in 2018. A recent example that made the news headlines was the young girl with Down syndrome who was detained in America. And the reason why this news made headlines is because one of the White House officials made fun of this girl. And this is not the first time something like this has happened, but this is beyond inappropriate. And really, everybody should be talking about this, and everybody should be discussing how is this happening in 2018.
So what message would you send about how we can overcome these precepts and these first impressions about what a disability is and get down to what it can really be?
I mean, I think first and foremost is we need to be talking about this, not only within academic spaces, or not only when we're talking about policies that are, sort of quote unquote for people with disabilities. Really, this is a topic that everybody needs to be talking about. Disability rights are human rights. And we really need to all hone in on that and examine why disability rights are not sort of under the general the general principle of human rights. Like why are we often talking about them as two separate things? So I think the discussions. I mean, one of the things I learned at this summit was the discussions in and of themselves are really, really helpful, because they bring to light issues on both a local and an international scale. As well, we have to hold people who are in power accountable and say, why are we having discriminatory policies? Like, how is this able to happen, right? Like, how is it that a 10-year-old girl with Down syndrome is locked up for seeking asylum? Like, this, it just doesn't make sense when we're thinking of international human rights laws. So I think we have to talk about it, and we also have to examine our practices and change those practices by calling people in authority to, you know, calling them out on it and really working towards social and political change.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure, no problem. Thank you.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Canadian Blood Services invites you to save a life today. Every 60 seconds, someone in Canada needs blood. Donating is simple, and your blood will go to help Canadians undergoing heart surgery, leukemia treatment, or those involved in an accident. Go online and book your appointment today at www.blood.ca or give us a call toll-free at 1-888-2-DONATE. That's 1-888-236-6283.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Sukaina Dada from York University and from Bev Watson from Dreams Take Flight. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Steve Esty, who'll be telling us a little bit about his experiences with the UN Convention on People with Disabilities. So tell me a little bit about your experience with the UN Convention concerning people with disabilities.
Sure, happy to do so, Cam. The convention was negotiated at the UN between 2002 and 2006. And in those years, I was a staff person for Disabled Peoples International, the Canadian-based NGO working in the area of international disability rights. And I also served as a civil society advisor to the Government of Canada during the negotiation. So I was involved on the NGO side, but also in terms of providing advice to the Canadian government based on work that we were doing here in Canada with consumer organizations while the convention was drafted between 2002 and 2006.
So what were some of the biggest needs for people with disabilities that were addressed?
Good question. I mean, that's I guess that really, for me, you know, aside from specific needs and particular rights and so on, the larger question is how we envision people with disabilities in our society, in our community. And the convention really changes the framework for that. Previous to the convention, people with disabilities in a lot of countries around the world, not so much in Canada, but in a lot of other countries, people were really viewed, I think, as objects of charity. What the convention does is it tries to change that paradigm and say, we are not objects of charity, but we are instead holders of human rights, so we are subjects of the human rights system. And the things that we need are our basic human rights in the same way that everyone else does, whether it's a right to education or a right to health or whatever it is. But the point that the convention makes is that these are not special things. These are the things that every human being has a right to, including people with disabilities. So the point of the convention for me has always been to reframe the discussion away from there being special needs for people with disabilities. I'd rather to say that people with disabilities have exactly the same needs as everyone else, but there are perhaps different ways of achieving those things.
So, were there any challenges in drafting the convention and getting everyone to come to a consensus?
Oh, yeah. Lots of challenges. I mean, you can imagine, I think by the time we came to the end of the negotiations in 2006, there were delegations from about 140 countries around the world that were participating. Plus, there were many, many, I'm talking hundreds, of civil society people involved in the discussion. So in the last days of the negotiations, there were hundreds of people in the UN negotiating room, and lots of different opinions about a lot of different things. So it was a challenge to come to consensus around the language of the convention and the spirit of the convention and so on. And I think that, you know, a lot of times people look at the convention now, 10 years later, and say, well, gee, it's not all it could be when it talks about the right to education or the right to health or the right to work or whatever it might be. But you need to keep in mind that the convention, like any UN convention, whether it's a disability rights convention or an environmental convention or whatever it is a consensus document, because that's the way the UN works. You come to consensus on things, and oftentimes the language is not as robust as some might like, but it's language that everyone can live with, and it sets certain standards and begins to move things in a particular direction. And I think that, you know, a decade after the treaty entered into force, we can say with some amount of confidence that it has begun to move things in a different direction. And I think that's the real value of things. And the value of that is facilitated by the consensual approach that's taken in the UN discussion.
So in your time working on creating the convention, was there any success moment that stands out for you?
There were lots of little successes along the way, I think. I mean, it was a tremendous honor and privilege to be even in the room when those discussions were taking place. But I think one of the things that really stands out for me, and stands out for me not just as someone who participated in the treaty drafting itself, but as a Canadian who participated in that, was early in the negotiations, there was a lot of tension around the role of organizations of people with disabilities in the actual drafting. Because typically in a UN process, governments do the drafting, governments do the negotiations and so on. But what happened with the Disability Convention was it became apparent that the government didn't really have a rich understanding of the lived experience of persons with disabilities. So it became clear that we needed to find a way to include civil society in this, because there weren't many disabled people who were part of government delegations at the beginning, particularly in 2002 and 2003. Most of the people who were doing the negotiating, and by that I mean making formal interventions on the floor at the UN, were lawyers from foreign services around the world and people who were involved with the UN system and so on. But that doesn't really understand much about disability. So there was a kind of a gap in what was going on there. But at the same time, there wasn't a lot of precedent for civil society participation in these kinds of negotiations. So there was a lot of pushback because some countries were concerned that if civil society groups got involved, it would change the dynamic, and they weren't keen for that. But against that background, there was a lot of push from civil society groups that we needed to be involved, hence the slogan that you often hear when people talk about the convention, the slogan, nothing about us without us, comes from those days and comes from that dynamic between government and civil society groups. And in 2003, this really came to a head, and some governments said, there's no place for civil society groups to make interventions on the floor, but Canada took a strong stand on this point, and Canada's ambassador to the United Nations at the time made a statement on the floor that said, in Canada's view, it was imperative that civil society organizations and people with disabilities be centrally involved in the discussion. And the Canadian delegation went so far at that time as to say, if there wasn't a facility for this developed, then Canada wouldn't be part of the negotiation. So Canada really drew a line in the sand at that point, and it allowed countries to line up behind us and support us. And that then allowed for, or paved the way for, civil society to be really centrally involved in the discussion. I don't mean to say by this that was a sole thing that Canada did on its own, but Canada took a very principled position at that point, and I think that it was a particularly proud moment for me as a Canadian, and certainly a proud moment for me as a person with a disability in the negotiation process.
I'd thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. This, my friends, was a real honor to have put on the show, and so much as being able to communicate with one of the people who helped make the convention possible. It's not the sole defining document when it comes to disability rights, but it is a global statement that people with disabilities are here, they are part of the equation, their voices count. And no matter who brings perspectives to the table, as long as people with disabilities are included and they have their voices heard, I think it can be a balancing act between those who know how to create these things and those who need them created. For the simple fact is, we can all sit back, speculate on what a person with a disability needs till we're blue in the face, but if we never ask them the question, we never say, is this really something that would benefit you? We don't make progress. But the fact that they were bringing in people with disabilities to help make this happen, truly extraordinary, my friends. And all these years later, yeah, there's some discussion, some disagreement, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. Progress can be made by having those conversations. Any law that's worth its salt can stand a little scrutiny, I think. But the fact is, the world is taking notice of this. The world is recognizing that people with disabilities have value and have something to contribute. And this clearly states, on a massive, massive scale, people with disabilities are going to have that same consideration. It's inevitable, I think. People can't hear about an oppressed group or a marginalized group in society without wanting to take action. It is how any progress is made, really. People hear about a need. They like to fill it, because people are, at their core, decent. And that's basically what this charter says. People with disabilities have a need for respect and a right to access. We're going to fill that need. We're going to make sure that everybody knows that this is, it's binding. It is a protection, and we recognize it no matter where we're coming from. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.